Track. Its headlights illuminate the primeval forest in bright, sweeping moments. Here. Once again, Napier hears the lost river. He remembers the first time he brought Millie up to the cabin he, his brothers, and his dad built. Now he's the last one left. They went skinny dipping that night. The forest dusk fills his lungs and his head. No phones, no CCTV or just TV, no ID clearances, no meetings in the president's soundproofed office. Not ever again. The retired security man checks the padlock on the door for signs of tampering before he opens the shutters. Relax, for Christ's sakes. Seaboard let you go, free. No strings, no comeback. Nonetheless, his .38 is in his hand as he enters the cabin. See? Nobody. Napier gets a fire crackling and fixes himself beans and sausages and sooty baked potatoes. A couple of beers. A long, long piss outdoors. The fizzing Milky Way. A deep, deep sleep. Awake again. Parched with a beer-swollen bladder. Fifth time now or sixth. The sounds of the forest don't lullaby Napier tonight, but itch his sense of well-being. A car's brakes. An elf owl. Twigs snapping. A rat, a mountain quail, I don't know. You're in a forest, it could be anything. Go to sleep, Napier. The wind. Voices under the window. Napier wakes to find a cougar crouched on a crossbeam over his bed. He wakes up with a yell. The cougar was Bill Smoke, arm poised to stove Napier's head in with a flashlight. Nothing on the crossbeam. Is it raining this time? Napier listens. Only the river, only the river. He lights another match to see if it's a time worth getting up for. 4:05. No. An in-between hour. Napier nestles down in folded darkness for holes of sleep. But recent memories of Margot Roker's house find him. Bill Smoke saying, "Stand guard. My contact says she keeps her documents in her room." Napier agreeing, glad to reduce his involvement. Bill Smoke switching on his hefty rubber flashlight and going upstairs. Napier scanning Roker's orchard. The nearest house was over half a mile away. Wondering why the solo operator Bill Smoke wanted him along for this simple job. A frail scream. An abrupt ending. Napier running upstairs, slipping, a series of empty rooms. Bill Smoke kneeling on an antique bed, clubbing something on the bed with his flashlight, the beam whipping the walls and ceiling. The near noiseless thump as it lands on the senseless head of Margot Roker, her blood on the bedsheets, obscenely scarlet and wet. Napier, shouting for him to stop. Bill Smoke turned around, huffing. "What's up, Joe?" "You said she was out tonight." "No, no, you heard wrong. I said my contact said the old woman was out tonight. Reliable staff. Hard to find."
"Christ! Christ! Christ! Is she dead?"
"Better safe than sorry, Joe." A neat little setup, Joe Napier admits in his sleepless cabin. A shackle of compliance, party to the clubbing of a defenseless elderly activist. Any dropout law student with a speech impediment could send him to prison for the rest of his life. A blackbird sings. "I did a great wrong by Margot Roker, but I've left that life." Four small shrapnel scars, two in each buttock, ache. "I went out on a limb to get Louisa Ray wised up." The window is light enough to discern Millie in her frame. "I'm only one man," he protests. "I'm not a platoon. All I want out of life is life and a little fishing." Joe Napier sighs, dresses, and begins reloading the Jeep. Millie always won by saying nothing. 56. Judith Ray, barefoot, fastens her kimono-style dressing gown and crosses a vast Byzantine rug to her marble-floored kitchen. She takes out 3 ruby grapefruits from a cavernous refrigerator, halves them, then feeds the snow-cold dripping hemispheres into a juicer. The machine buzzes like trapped wasps, and a jug fills with pulpy, pearly, candy-colored juice. She pours herself a heavy blue glass and sloshes the liquid around every nook of her mouth. On the striped veranda sofa, Louisa scans the paper and chews a croissant. The magnificent view, over Ewingsville's moneyed roofs and velveteen lawns to downtown Buenos Aires, where skyscrapers rear from sea mist and commuter smog, has an especial otherworldliness at this hour.
Not sleeping in, Cookie?
Morning. No. I'm going to collect my stuff from the office, if you don't mind me borrowing one of the cars again.
Sure.
Judith Ray reads her daughter.
You were wasting your talents at Spyglass, Cookie. It was a squalid little magazine.
True, Mom, but it was my squalid little magazine. Judith Ray settles on the arm of the sofa and shoos an impertinent fly from her glass. She examines a circled article in the business section. Energy guru Lloyd Hooks to head Seaboard Inc. In a joint statement, the White House and electricity giant Seaboard Power Inc. have announced Federal Power Commissioner Lloyd Hooks is to fill the CEO's seat left vacant by Alberto Grimaldi's tragic death in an airplane accident 2 days ago. Seaboard's share price on Wall Street leaped 40 points in response to the news. "We're delighted Lloyd has accepted our offer to come on board," said Seaboard Vice CEO William Wiley. "And while the circumstances behind the appointment couldn't be sadder, the board feels Alberto in heaven joins with us today as we extend the warmest welcome to a visionary new chief executive." Menzies Graham, Power Commission spokesman, said, "Lloyd Hook's expertise will obviously be missed here in Washington, but President Ford respects his wishes and looks forward to an ongoing liaison with one of the finest minds tackling today's energy challenges and keeping our great nation great. Mr. Hooks is to take up his new responsibilities next week. His successor is due to be announced later today."
"Is this a project you were working on?" asks Judith.
"Still am."
"On whose behalf?"
"On behalf of the truth." Her daughter's irony is sincere.
"I'm freelance." "Since when?"
"Since the moment KPO fired me. Firing me was a political decision, Mom. It proves I was onto something big. Mammoth." Judith Ray watches the young woman.
"Once upon a time, I had a baby daughter. I dressed her in frilly frocks, enrolled her for ballet classes, and sent her to horse riding camp 5 summers in a row. But look at her. She turned into Lester anyway."
She kisses Louisa's forehead. Louisa frowns, suspiciously, like a teenager.
"What?"
57. Louisa Ray drops into the snow-white diner for the last coffee of her Spyglass days. The only free seat is adjacent to a man hidden behind the San Francisco Chronicle. Louisa thinks, "A good paper," and takes the seat. Dom Grelsch says, "Morning." Louisa feels a flare of territorial jealousy. "What are you doing here?" "Even editors eat. I've come here every morning since my wife's, you know. Waffles I can make in the toaster, but..." His gesture at his platter of pork chops implies, need I say more?
"I never saw you in here once."
"That's 'cause he leaves," says Bart, performing 3 tasks at once. "An hour before you arrive." "Usual, Louisa?"
"Please."
"How come you never told me, Bart?" "I don't talk about your comings and goings to no one else either." First one into the office. Dom Grelsch folds the newspaper. Last one out at night. Editor's lot. I wanted a word with you, Louisa.
I have a distinct memory of having been fired.
Can it, will ya?
I want to say why, how I'm not resigning over how Ogilvy crapped on you. And since my confessions are rolling out, I knew you were in for the axe since last Friday.
Nice of you to let me know beforehand.
The editor lowers his voice.
You know about my wife's leukemia, our insurance situation?
Louisa decides to grant him a nod. Grelsch steels himself.
Last week, during the takeover negotiations, it was intimated if I stayed on at Spyglass and agreed I'd never heard of a certain report, strings could be pulled at my insurers.
Louisa maintains her composure.
You trust these people to keep their word?
On Sunday morning, my claims man, Arnold Frum, phones.
Apologies for disturbing us, blah blah, but he thought we'd want to know. Blue Shield reversed their decision and will be handling all my wife's medical bills. A reimbursement check for past payments is in the mail. We even get to keep our house. I'm not proud of myself, but I won't be ashamed for putting my family ahead of the truth.
The truth is radiation raining on Buenas Yerbas.
We all make choices about levels of risk. If I can protect my wife in return for playing a bit part in the chance of an accident at Swanakie, well, I'll have to live with that. I sure as hell wish you'd think a little more about the risk you're exposing yourself to by taking these people on.
Louise's memory of sinking underwater returns to haunt her, and her heart lurches. Bart places a cup of coffee in front of her. Grelsch slips a typewritten page over the counter. It contains two columns of seven names per column.
Guess what this list is?
Two names jump out. Lloyd Hooks and William Wiley.
Board members of Transvision, Inc.?
Grelsch nods.
Almost. Board membership is a matter of public knowledge. This is a list of unlisted corporate advisors who receive money sourced in Transvision, Inc. The circled names should interest you. Look, Hooks and Wiley.
Lazy, damning, just plain greedy. Louisa pockets the list.
I should thank you for this.
Nussbaum the Fowl did the digging.
One last thing. Fran Peacock at the Western Messenger, you know her?
Just to say hi at superficial media parties.
Fran and me go back a ways. I dropped by her office last night, mentioned your story's salient points. I was noncommittal, but once you've got battle-worthy evidence, she'd like to say more than just hi.
Is this in the spirit of your understanding with Transvision, Inc.?
Grelsch stands up and folds his newspaper.
They never said I couldn't share my contacts.
58. Jerry Nussbaum returns the car keys to Louisa.
Dear God in heaven, let me be reincarnated as your mother's sports car. I don't care which one.
That's the last of the boxes?
Yep, says Louisa.
And thanks.
Nussbaum shrugs like a modest maestro.
The place'll sure feel empty without a real woman to crack chauvinist jokes on. Nance is actually a man after so many decades in a newsroom.
Nancy O'Hagan thumps her jammed typewriter and gives Nussbaum the finger.
Yeah, like...
Roland Jakes surveys Louisa's empty desk, glumly.
I still don't believe how, you know, the new guys would give you the high jump but keep on a mollusk like Nussbaum.
Nancy O'Hagan hisses, cobra-like.
How can Grelsch... She jabs her cigar at his office. Just roll over, waving his feet in the air, and let KPO stiff you like that.
Wish me luck.
Luck? Jake scoffs. You don't need luck. Don't know why you stayed with this dead shark for so long.
The 70s is gonna see satire's dying gasp.
It's true what Lair said. A world that'll award Henry Kissinger the Nobel Peace Prize throws us all out of a job.
Oh, Nussbaum remembers. I came back via the mailroom. Something for you.
He hands Louisa a padded khaki envelope. She doesn't recognize the crabbed, looping script. She slits open the envelope. Inside is a safety deposit key, wrapped in a short note. Louisa's expression intensifies as her eyes move down the note. She double-checks the label on the key. Third Bank of California, 9th Street. Where's that?
Downtown, answers O'Hagan. Where 9th crosses Flanders Boulevard.
Catch you all next time. Louisa is going. It's a small world. It keeps recrossing itself. 59. Waiting for the lights to change, Louisa glances once more at Six Smith's letter to triple-check she hasn't missed anything. It was written in a hurried script. BY International Airport, 3rd April, 1975. Dear Miss Ray, forgive this scribbled note. I have been warned by a well-wisher at Seaboard I am in imminent danger of my life. Exposing the Hydra Zero's defects calls for excellent health, so I will act on this tip-off. I will be in touch with you as soon as I can from Cambridge or via the IAEA. In the meantime, I have taken the liberty of depositing my report on Swanakee B in a strong box at the Third Bank of California on 9th Street. You will need it should anything happen to me. Be careful. In haste, R.S. Angry horns blast as Louisa fumbles with the unfamiliar transmission. After 13th Street, the city loses its moneyed Pacific character. Carob trees, watered by the city, give way to buckled streetlights. Joggers do not pant down these side streets. The neighborhood could be from any manufacturing zone in any industrial belt. Bums doze on benches. Weeds crack the sidewalk. Skins get darker block by block. Flyers cover barricaded doors. Graffiti spreads across every surface below the height of a teenager holding a spray can. The garbage collectors are on strike, again, and mounds of rubbish putrefy in the sun. Pawn shops, nameless laundromats, and grocers scratch a lean living from threadbare pockets. After more blocks and streetlights, the shops give way to anonymous manufacturing firms and housing projects. Louisa has never even driven through this district, and feels unsettled by the unknowability of cities. Was Six Smith's logic to hide his report, and then hide the hiding place? She comes to Flanders Boulevard and sees the Third Bank of California dead ahead, with a customer's parking lot around the side. Louisa doesn't notice the battered black Chevy parked across the street. 60. Fay Lee, in visor sunglasses and a sun hat, checks her watch against the bank's clock. The air conditioning is losing its battle against the mid-morning heat. She dabs perspiration from her face and forearms with a handkerchief, fans herself, and assesses recent developments. Joe Napier, you look dumb, but you're deep down smart, smart enough to know when to bow out. Louisa Ray should be here any time now, if Bill Smoke was on the money. Bill Smoke, you look smart, but you're deep down dumb. And your men aren't as loyal as you think. Because you don't do it for the money. You forgot how easily lesser mortals can be bought. Two well-dressed Chinese men walk in. A look from one tells her Louisa Ray is coming. The three converge at a desk guarding a side corridor. Safety deposit boxes. This facility has had very little traffic all morning. Fei Li considered getting a plant in place, but a minimum wage rent-a-guard's natural laxness is safer than giving triad men a sniff of the prize.
Hi.
Fei Li fires off her most intolerable Chinese accent at the guard.
Brothers and I want get from strongbox.
She dangles a deposit box key.
Looky, we got key.
The bored youth has a bad skin problem.
ID?
ID here. You looky. ID, you looky.
The Chinese ideograms repel white scrutiny with their ancient tribal magic. The guard nods down the corridor and returns to his Aliens magazine.
Door's not locked.
I'd fire your ass on the spot, kid, thinks Fei Li. The corridor ends at a reinforced door, left ajar. Beyond is the deposit box room, shaped like a three-pronged fork. One associate joins her up the left prong, and she orders the other down the right. About 600 boxes in here. One of them hides a $5 million, $10,000 per page report. Footsteps approach down the corridor, clipping female heels. The vault door swings open.
Anyone here? Calls Louisa Ray.
Silence. As the door clangs shut, the two men rush the woman. Louisa is gripped with a hand over her mouth.
Thank you.
Fei Li prizes the key from the reporter's fingers. Its engraved number is 3664. She wastes no words.
Bad news. This room is soundproof, unmonitored, and my friends and I are armed. The Six Smith report isn't destined for your hands. Good news? I'm acting for clients who want the Hydra strangled at birth and Seaboard discredited. Six Smith's findings will hit the news networks within 2 or 3 days. Whether they want to pursue the corporate executions is their business.
Don't look at me like that, Louisa. Truth doesn't care who discovers it, so why should you?
Even better news. Nothing bad will happen to you. My associate will escort you to a holding location in BY. By evening, you'll be a free woman. You won't cause us any trouble.
Fei Li produces a photo of Javier from Louisa's bulletin board and waves it an inch from her face.
Because we'd reciprocate in kind.
Submission replaces defiance in Louisa's eyes.
I knew you had a fine head on your shoulders.
Fei Li addresses the man holding Louisa in Cantonese.
Take her to the lockup. Nothing dirty before you shoot her. She may be a reporter, but that doesn't make her a total whore. Dispose of the body in the usual way.
They leave. The second associate remains by the door, holding it ajar. Fei Li locates strongbox 3664 at neck height, at the tip of the middle prong. The key turns, and the door swings open. Fei Li pulls out a vanilla binder. The Hydra Zero Reactor, an operational assessment model, Project Head Dr. Rufus Sixsmith. Unauthorized possession is a federal crime under the Military and Industrial Espionage Act, 1971. Fei Li permits herself a jubilant smile. The land of opportunity. Then she sees two wires trailing from inside the binder to the back of the strongbox. She peers in. A red diode blinks on a neat 4x2 bundle of taped cylinders, wires, components.
Bill Smoke, you goddamn...
61. The blast picks Louisa Ray up and throws her forward irresistibly like a Pacific breaker. The corridor rotates through 90 degrees several times and pounds into Louisa's ribs and head. Petals of pain unfold across her vision. Masonry groans. Chunks of plaster, tile, and glass shower, drizzle, stop. An ominous peace.
What am I living through?
Calls for help spring up in the dust and smoke. Screams from the street, alarm bells drill the burnt air. Louisa's mind reactivates. A bomb. The rent-a-guard croaks and moans. Blood from his ear trickles into a delta flooding his shirt collar. Louisa tries to pull herself away, but her right leg has been blown off. The shock dies. Her leg is just jammed under her unconscious Chinese escort. She pulls free and crawls, stiff and hurting, across the lobby, now transformed into a movie set. Louisa finds the vault door, blown off its hinges. Must have missed me by inches. Broken glass, upended chairs, chunks of wall, cut and shocked people. Oily black smoke belches from the ducts, and a sprinkler system kicks in. Louisa is drenched and choked, slips on the wet floor and stumbles, dazed, bent double into others. A friendly hand takes Louisa's wrist.
I got you, ma'am. I got you. Let me help you outside. There may be another explosion.
Louisa allows herself to be led into congested sunlight, where a wall of faces looks on, hungry for horror. The fireman guides her across a road blocked with gridlocked cars, and she is reminded of April's war footage from Saigon. Smoke still spills in senseless quantities.
Get away! Over here! Get back! Over there!
Louisa, the journalist, is trying to tell Louisa, the victim, something. She has grit in her mouth.
Something urgent,
she asks her rescuer. How did you get on the scene so soon?
It's okay, he insists. You have a concussion.
A fireman? I can make my own way now.
No, you'll be safe this way.
The door of a dusty black Chevy swings open.
Let go of me.
His grip is iron.
In the car, now, he mutters, or I'll blow your fucking brains out.
The bomb was supposed to get me, and now... Louise's abductor grunts and falls forward. 62. Joe Napier grabs Louisa Ray's arm and swings her away from the Chevy.
Christ, that was close.
A baseball bat is in his other hand. If you want to live to see this day out, you'd better come with me.
Okay, thinks Louisa.
Okay,
she says. Napier pulls her back into the jockeying crowd to block Bill Smoke's line of fire, hands the baseball bat to a bewildered boy, and marches toward 81st Avenue, away from the Chevy.
Walk discreetly, or run for it and break your cover.
My car's next to the bank, says Louisa.
We'll be sitting ducks in this traffic, says Napier. Bill Smoke's got two more ape men. They'll just fire through the window. Can you walk?
I can run, Napier.
They advance a third of the way down the block, but then Napier makes out Bill Smoke's face ahead, his hand hovering around his jacket pocket. Napier checks behind him. A second goon is the second pincer. Across the road is a third. There won't be any cops on the scene for minutes yet, and they have mere seconds. Two killings in broad daylight. Risky, but the stakes are high enough for them to chance it, and there's so much chaos here they'll get away with it. Napier is desperate. They are level with a windowless warehouse. Up these steps, he tells Louisa, praying the door opens. It does. A sparse reception area, shady and lit by a single tube. A tomb of flies. Napier bolts the door behind them. From behind a desk, a young girl in her Sunday best and an aged poodle in a cardboard box bed watch, unperturbed. Three exits at the far end. The noise of machinery is monolithic. A black-eyed Mexican woman swoops from nowhere and flutters in his face.
No legals here! No legals here! Boss away! Boss away! Come back another day!
Louisa Ray addresses her in very battered Spanish. The Mexican woman glares, then jerks a savage thumb at the exits. A blow crunches the outer door. Napier and Louisa run across the echoing chamber.
Left or right? Demands Napier.
Don't know,
gasps Louisa. Napier looks back for guidance from the Mexican, but the street door shutters under one blow, splinters under the next, and flies open with a third. Napier pulls Louisa through the left exit. 63. Bisco and Roper, Bill Smoke's sidemen, body charge the door. In the courtroom of his head, Bill Smoke finds William Wiley and Lloyd Hooks guilty of gross negligence. "I told you Joe Napier couldn't be trusted to pack up his conscience and pick up his fishing rods." The door is in pieces. A spidery Mexican woman inside is having hysterics. A placid child and a bedecked poodle sit on an office desk.
"FBI," Bisco yells, flourishing his driver's license. "Which way did they go?"
The Mexican woman screeches.
"We care our workers. Very good. Very much pay. No need union."
Bisco takes out his gun and blasts the poodle against the wall.
"Which way did they fucking go?"
"Jesus, Muhammad, Christ, this is why I work alone."
The Mexican woman bites her fist, shudders, and launches a rising wail.
"Brilliant, Bisco. Like the FBI kills poodles."
Roper leans over the child, who hasn't responded in any way to the death of the dog.
"Which exit did the man and the woman take?"
She gazes back as if he is nothing but a pleasant sunset.
"You speak English?"
A hysteric, a mute, a dead dog. Bill Smoke walks to the three exits, and a pair of fuck-ups royale.
"We're losing time. Roper, right door. Bisco, left. I'm in the middle."
64. Rows, aisles, and 10-box-high walls of cardboard conceal the true dimensions of the storeroom. Napier wedges the door shut with a cart.
"Tell me you've gotten over your gun allergy since yesterday," he hisses.
Louisa shakes her head.
"You?"
"Only a pop gun. 6 shots. Come on." Even as they run, she hears the door being forced. Napier blocks the line of vision with a tower of boxes. Then again, a few yards down. A third tower topples ahead of them, however, and dozens of big birds. Louisa recognizes the dim-wit yellow emu from the children's program Hal used to watch between jobs. Spill free. Napier gestures. "Run with your head down." 5 seconds later, a bullet rips through cardboard 3 inches shy of Louisa's head, and Big Bird stuffing poofs into her face. She trips and collides with Napier. A rod of noise sears the air above them. Napier draws his gun and fires twice around Louisa. The noise makes her curl into a ball.
"Run!"
barks Napier, grabbing her upright. Louisa obeys. Napier starts knocking down walls of boxes to impede their pursuer. 10 yards later, Louisa gets to a corner. A plywood door is marked Emergency Exit. Locked. Breathless, Joe Napier reaches her. He fails to force the door.
"Give it up, Napier," they hear. "It's not you we're after."
Napier fires point blank at the lock. The door still won't open. He empties 3 more bullets into the lock. Each bang makes Louisa flinch. The 4th bang is an empty click. Napier kicks the door with the sole of his boot. An underworld sweatshop clattering with 500 sewing machines. Flakes of textile are suspended in the viscous heat, haloing the naked bulbs hanging over each machinist. Louisa and Napier skirt the outer walkway in a rapid semi-crouch. Limp Donald Ducks and crucified Scooby-Doos have their innards stitched, one by one, row by row, pallet by pallet. Each woman keeps her eyes fixed on the needle plates, so Louisa and Napier cause little commotion.
"But how do we get out of here?"
Napier runs literally into the Mexican woman from the makeshift reception. She beckons them down a semi-blocked, unlit side passage. Napier turns to Louisa, yelling over the metallic din, his face saying, "Do we trust her?" Louisa's face replies. Any better ideas? They follow the woman between reams of fabric and wire, split boxes of teddy bear eyes, and assorted sewing machine body shells and innards. The passage corners right and stops at an iron door. Day filters in through a grimy grill. The Mexican fumbles with her key ring. It's 1875 down here, thinks Louisa, not 1975. One key won't fit. The next fits but won't turn. Even 30 seconds on the factory floor has affected her hearing. A war cry from 6 yards away. Hands in the air! Louisa spins around. I said hands in the fucking air! Louisa's hands obey. The gunman keeps his pistol trained on Napier. Turn around, Napier. Slow. Drop your gun. The señora shrills.
No shoot I, señor. They force I show door. They say they kill.
Shut up, you crazy fucking wetback. Scram. Out of my way. The woman creeps around him, pressing herself against the wall, shrieking.
No dispares. No dispares. No quiero morir.
Napier shouts through the funneled factory noise. Easy now. Bisco, how much you being paid? Bisco hollers back. Don't bother, Napier. Last words. I can't hear you. What did you say? What are your last words? Last words? Who are you, Dirty Harry? Bisco's mouth twitches. I got a book of last words, and those were yours. You? He looks at Louisa, keeping the gun trained on Napier. A pistol shot punches a hole in the din, and Louisa's eyes clench shut. A hard thing touches her toe. She forces her eyes open. It is a handgun skidded to a stop. Bisco's face is contorted into inexplicable agony. The señora's monkey wrench flashes and crumples the gunman's lower jaw. 10 or more blows of extreme ferocity follow, each one making Louisa flinch, punctuated by the words,
Yo amaba a ese, jodido, pero...
Louisa checks Joe Napier. He looks on, unhurt, thunderstruck. The señora wipes her mouth and leans over the motionless, pulp-faced Bisco.
And don't call me wetback.
She steps over his clotted head and unlocks the exit. You might want to tell the other two I did that to him, Napier says to her, retrieving Bisco's gun. The señora addresses Louisa.
Quítatelo de encima, cariño. Anda con gentuza y... Dios mío, ese viejo podría ser tu padre.
65. Napier sits on the graffiti-frescoed subway train, watching Lester Ray's daughter. She is dazed, disheveled, shaky, and her clothes are still damp from the bank's sprinkler. How did you find me? She asks, finally. Big fat guy at your office. Nussbaum or something? Nussbaum. That's it. Took a heap of persuading. A silence lasts from Reunion Square subway to 17th Avenue. Louisa picks at a hole in her jeans. I guess you don't work at Seaboard any longer. I was put out to pasture yesterday.
Fired?
No. Early retirement. Yes. I was put out to pasture. And you came back from the pasture this morning. That's about the size of it. The next silence lasts from 17th Avenue to McKnight Park. I feel, Louisa hesitates, that you broke some sort of decree back there. As if Buenos Aires had decided I was to die today, but here I am. Napier considers this. No, the city doesn't care. And you could say it was your father who just saved your life, when he kicked away that grenade rolling my way 30 years ago. Their compartment groans and shudders. We've got to go via a gun store. Empty guns make me nervous. The subway emerges into the sunlight. Louisa squints. Where are we going?
To see somebody.
Napier checks his watch. She's flown in specially. Louisa rubs her red eyes. Can the somebody give us a copy of the Six Smith report? Because that dossier is my only way out.
I don't know yet.
66. Megan Six Smith sits on a low bench in the Buenos Aires Museum of Modern Art and stares back at a giant portrait of an old lady's ursine face, rendered in interlacing gray and black lines on a canvas otherwise blank. The only figurative in a room of Pollux, de Kooning's, and Miro's, the portrait quietly startles.
Look, she says, thinks Megan, at your future. Your face, too, will one day be mine.
Time has knitted her skin into webs of wrinkles. Muscles sag here, tauten there. Her eyelids droop. Her pearls are of inferior quality, most likely, and her hair is mussed from an afternoon of rounding up grandchildren.
But she sees things I don't.
A woman about her own age sits next to her. She could use a wash and a change of clothes.
Megan Sixsmith?
Megan glances sidelong.
Louisa Ray?
She nods toward the portrait. I've always liked her. My dad met her, the real lady, I mean. She was a Holocaust survivor who settled in BY, ran a boarding house over in Little Lisbon. She was the artist's landlady.
Courage grows anywhere, thinks Megan Sixsmith. Like weeds.
Joe Napier said you flew in today from Honolulu.
Is he here?
The guy behind me, in the denim shirt, pretending to look at the Warhol. He's watching out for us. I'm afraid his paranoia is justified.
Yes. I need to know you are who you say you are.
I'm happy to hear it. Any ideas?
What was my uncle's favorite Hitchcock movie?
The woman claiming to be Louisa Ray thinks for a while and smiles. We talked about Hitchcock in the elevator. I'm guessing he wrote you about that. But I don't remember him naming a favorite. He admired that wordless passage in Vertigo, where Jimmy Stewart trails the mysterious woman to the waterfront with the San Francisco backdrop. He enjoyed Charade. I know that's not Hitchcock, but it tickled him, you calling Audrey Hepburn a bubblehead. Megan reclines into the seat. Yes, my uncle referred to you in a card he wrote from the airport hotel. It was agitated and worrying, and dotted with phrases like, if anything should happen to me. But it wasn't suicidal. Nothing could make Rufus do what the police claimed, I'm certain.
Ask her, and control your trembling for God's sake.
Ms. Ray, do you think my uncle was murdered? Louisa Ray replies, I'm afraid I know he was. I'm sorry. The journalist's conviction is cathartic. Megan takes a deep breath. I know about his work for Seaboard and the Defense Department. I never saw the whole report, but I checked its mathematics when I visited Rufus back in June. We vetted each other's work.
The Defense Department? You don't mean energy.
Defense. A byproduct of the Hydra Zero reactor is weapons-grade uranium. Highest quality, lots of it. Megan lets Louisa Ray digest the new implications.
What do you need?
The report. Only the report will bring Seaboard crashing down in public and legal arenas. And, incidentally, save my own skin.
Trust this stranger or get up and walk away.
A crocodile of schoolchildren clusters around the portrait of the old woman. Megan murmurs under the curator's short speech.
Rufus kept academic papers, data, notes, early drafts, etc., on Starfish, his yacht, for future reference. His funeral isn't until next week. Probate won't begin until then. So this cache should still be untouched. I would bet a lot he had a copy of his report aboard. Seaboard's people may have already combed the boat, but he had a thing about not mentioning Starfish at work. Where's Starfish moored now?
67.
Cape Yerba's Marina Royale, proud home of the prophetess, best-preserved schooner in the world. Napier parks the rented Ford by the clubhouse, a weather-boarded former boathouse. Its bright windows boast an inviting bar, and nautical flags ruffle stiff in the evening wind. Sounds of laughter and dogs are carried from the dunes as Louisa and Napier cross the clubhouse garden and descend the steps to the sizable marina. A three-masted wooden ship is silhouetted against the dying east, towering over the sleek fiberglass yachts around it. Some people move on the jetties and yachts, but not many. Starfish is moored on the furthest jetty away from the clubhouse. Louisa consults Megan Sixsmith's map, past the prophetess. The 19th century ship is indeed restored beautifully. Despite their mission, Louisa is distracted by a strange gravity that makes her pause for a moment and look at its rigging, listen to its wooden bones creaking. "What's wrong?" whispers Napier. "What is wrong?" Louisa's birthmark throbs. She grasps for the ends of this elastic moment, but they disappear into the past and the future. "Nothing."
"It's okay to be spooked. I'm spooked myself."
"Yeah."
"We're almost there."
Starfish is where Megan's map says. They clamber aboard. Napier inserts a clip into the cabin door and slides a popsicle stick into the gap. Louisa watches for watchers.
"Bet you didn't learn that in the army."
"You lose your bet. Cat burglars make resourceful soldiers, and the draft board wasn't choosy." A click. "Got it." The tidy cabin is devoid of books. An inset digital clock blinks from 2155 to 2156. Napier's flashlight's pencil beam rests on a navigation table fitted atop a mini filing cabinet.
"How about in there?"
Louisa opens a drawer. "This is it. Shine here." A mass of folders and binders. One, vanilla in color, catches her eye. "The Hydra Zero Reactor, an operational assessment model. Project head, Dr. Rufus Sixsmith." "Got it. This is it. Joe, you okay?"
"Yeah, it's just... about time something went well. So simply."
So Joe Napier can smile. A motion in the cabin doorway. A man blocks out the stars. Napier reads Louisa's alarm and whirls around. In the flashlight, Louisa sees a tendon in the gunman's wrist twitch, twice. But no gunfire sounds. Jammed safety catch? Joe Napier makes a hiccuping sound, slumps to his knees, and cracks his head on the steel foot of the navigation table. He lies inert. Louisa loses all but the dimmest sense of being herself. Napier's flashlight rolls in the gentle swell, and its beam rotates to show his shredded torso. His lifeblood spreads obscenely quickly, obscenely scarlet, obscenely shiny. Rigging whistles and twangs in the wind. The killer closes the cabin door behind him.
"Put the report on the table, Louisa."
His voice is kindly.
"I don't want blood on it."
She obeys. His face is hidden.
"Well, you get to make peace with your maker."
Louisa grips the table. "You're Bill Smoke. You killed Sixsmith." The darkness answers.
"Bigger forces than me. I just dispatched the bullet."
"Focus. You followed us, from the bank, in the subway, to the art museum."
"Does death always make you so verbose?"
Louisa's voice trembles.
What do you mean, always?
68. Joe Napier drifts in a torrential silence. The ghost of Bill Smoke hovers over his dark vision. More than half of himself has gone already. Words come, bruising the silence again.
He's going to kill her. That 38 in your pocket. I've done my duty. I'm dying, for Christ's sakes.
Hey, go tell Lester Ray about duty and dying. Napier's right hand inches to his buckle. He wonders if he is a baby in his cot or a man dying in his bed. Nights pass. No, lifetimes. Often Napier wants to ebb away, but his hand refuses to forget. The butt of a gun arrives in his palm. His finger enters a loop of steel, and a flare of clarity illuminates his purpose.
The trigger. This. Yes. Pull her out. Slowly now. Angle the gun.
Bill Smoke is just yards away. The trigger resists his index finger. Then a blaze of incredible noise spins Bill Smoke backwards, his arms flailing like a marionette's. In the fourth-to-last moment of his life, Napier fires another bullet into the marionette silhouetted by stars. The word Silva Plana comes to him, unasked for. In the third-to-last moment, Bill Smoke's body slides down the cabin door. Second-to-last, an inset digital clock blinks from 21:57 to 21:58. Napier's eyes sink. Newborn sunshine slants through ancient oaks and dances on a lost river.
Look, Joe. Herons.
69. In Margot Roker's ward in Swanequee County Hospital, Hester Van Zandt glances at her watch. 21:57. Visiting hours end at 10 o'clock. One more for the road, Margot? The visitor glances at her comatose friend, then leafs through her anthology of American poetry. A little Emerson. Ah, yes. Remember this one? You introduced it to me. If the red slayer thinks he slays, or if the slain think he is slain, they know not well the subtle ways I keep, and pass, and turn again. Far or forgot to me is near. Shadow and sunlight are the same. The vanished gods to me appear, and one to me are shame and fame. They'll reckon ill who leave me out. When me they fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt, and I the hymn the Brahmin sings. The strong gods pine for my abode, and pine in vain. Margot? 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 Margot Roker's eyelids vibrate as if in REM. A groan squirms in her larynx. She gulps for air. Then her eyes are wide open, blinking in confusion and alarm at the tubes in her nose. Hester Van Sant is also panicky, but with hope. Margot! Can you hear me? Margot! The patient's eyes settle on her old friend, and she lets her head sink into her pillow. Yes, I can hear you, Hester. You're shouting in my goddamn ear. 70. Louisa Ray surveys the October 1st edition of the Western Messenger amid the steamy clatter of the Snow White diner. Lloyd Hooks skips $250,000 bail. President Ford vows to root out crooks who bring ignominy to corporate America. A BYPD spokesman confirmed the newly appointed CEO of Seaboard Power, Inc., and former Federal Power Commissioner Lloyd Hooks has fled the country, forfeiting the $250,000 bail posted Monday. The latest twist to Seaboard Gate comes a day after Hooks swore to
defend my integrity and the integrity of our great American company against this pack of nefarious lies. President Ford entered the fray at a White House press conference, condemning his former advisor and distancing himself from the Nixon appointee. My administration makes no distinction between lawbreakers. We will root out the crooks who bring ignominy to corporate America and punish them with the utmost severity of the law. Lloyd Hook's disappearance, interpreted by many observers as an admission of guilt, is the latest twist in a series of revelations triggered by a September 4 incident at Cape Yerbus Marina Royale in which Joe Napier and Bill Smoke, security officers at Seaboard Inc.'s controversial Swanakie Island atomic power stations, shot each other. Eyewitness Louisa Ray, correspondent to this newspaper, summoned police to the crime scene, and the subsequent investigation has already spread to last month's killing of British atomic engineer and Seaboard consultant Dr. Rufus Sixsmith, the crash of former Seaboard CEO Alberto Grimaldi's Learjet over Pennsylvania 2 weeks ago, and an explosion in Third Bank of California in downtown BY, which claimed the lives of two people. Five directors at Seaboard Power have been charged in connection with the conspiracy, and two have committed suicide. Three more, including Vice CEO William Wiley, have agreed to testify against Seaboard Corporation. The arrest of Lloyd Hooks 2 days ago was seen as vindication of this newspaper's support for Louisa Ray's expose of this major scandal, initially dismissed by William Wiley as libelous fantasy culled from a spy novel and wholly unworthy of a serious response. Continued, page 2. Full story, page 5. Comment, page 11. Front page. Bart pours Louisa's coffee. Lester would be mighty proud. He'd say I'm just a journalist doing my job.
Well, exactly, Louisa.
Seaboard Gate is no longer her scoop. Swanakie swarms with reporters, Senate investigators, FBI agents, county police, and Hollywood scriptwriters. Swanakie B is in mothballs. C is suspended. Louisa gets Javier's postcard out again. It shows three UFOs zooming under the Golden Gate Bridge. Hi, Louisa. It's okay here, but we live in a house so I can't jump across balconies when I visit my friends. Paul, that's Wolfman, but Mom says I can't call him that anymore, though he kind of likes it when I do. Is taking me to a stamp fair tomorrow. Then I can choose what paint I want for my bedroom. And he cooks better than Mom. Saw you again on TV last night and in the papers. Don't forget me just because you're famous now, okay? Javi. The other item of mail is an airmailed package from Megan Sixsmith, sent in response to Louisa's request. It contains the final 8 letters Robert Frobisher wrote to his friend, Rufus Sixsmith. Louisa uses a plastic knife to slit the package open. She removes one of the yellowed envelopes, postmarked October 10, 1931, holds it against her nose, and inhales. Are molecules of Sadelhem Chateau, of Robert Frobisher's hand, dormant in this paper for 44 years, now swirling in my lungs, in my blood? Who is to say?
Letters from Sadelhem. Sadelhem, 10th, 1931. Sixsmith. Airs in bed for 3 days, fogged with morphine, calling out in pain, V distracting and distressing. Dr. Egret warns Jay and me not to confuse Airs's newfound joie de vivre in music with actual health, and forbids V.A. to work from his sickbed. Dr. Egret gives me the creeps. Never met a quack whom I didn't half suspect of plotting to do me in as expensively as he could contrive. Buried in music of my own. Cruel to say it, but when Hendrick arrives at breakfast and tells me, "Not today, Robert," I'm almost relieved. Spent last night working on a rumbling cello allegro lit by explosive triplets, silence punctuated by breakneck